This is Mod Love, the show that tackles dating, mating, and relating in the modern world, with your host, premier dating mentor and coach Jody Riley, and her partner from Straight Talk with Steve, Stephen Cardinal. Be sure to check out our previous episodes at modloveradio.com. And now, enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone. This is Jody Riley with my co-host,
Stephen Cardinal.
And you are listening to
Mod Love.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight, guys. We have a fantastic show tonight. I'm very excited. For our feature segment tonight, we are talking to Dr. Robert Shug. He is from the University of California at Long Beach.
And I believe I messed up his name on last week's show when I talked about it. I think I was saying Shrug. So
but it's Shug. Sorry. And I asked him how to say his name, and he said
I had an R in there even. So I could just shrug my shoulders and say that I messed up. So sorry about that, doctor.
But he's going to be talking to us tonight about psychopaths and sociopaths, and how you can recognize somebody who might be a psychopath or sociopath before you get into a relationship with them. You know, we talked a little bit about narcissism and that sort of thing before, and how to recognize that before you get into a relationship with somebody. So tonight he's going to talk to us about that, because I think most people out there think, oh, this will never happen to me, because, you know, psychopaths are like, they're like Ted Bundy or Charles Manson. You know, they're not, this is not the guy next door, but there's actually a book out there called The Psychopath Next Door. And you'd be surprised. I think it's about, I read the stats not too long ago. I think it's about 1% of the population is considered to be psychopathic, and the vast majority of those are not criminals.
Right. Yeah. So, they are not walking around with a cross tattoo on their forehead and wild staring eyes and doing all sorts of other stuff. They are just, so there's a range, right?
There's
some number that can go completely overboard and start, killing people and stuff. But there's a lot more that fall below that range that can still, I would imagine, give you a hard time in a relationship.
Right. It would be almost impossible to have some type of a relationship with someone who's a psychopath. I mean, and anybody who's ever, and as you're listening to Dr. Shug tonight talk about it, and you start recognizing, oh my God, maybe I've been in a relationship with somebody like that, you'll look back and you'll go, oh my God, that's why it didn't work. I wasn't crazy. This is what was going on. So it was a fantastic interview. So I'm very excited that I got a chance to talk to him. And he also talks a little bit about a book that he's written. It's more kind of like a textbook. But if you really are wanting to make sure that you don't find yourself in a relationship with somebody like this, it would probably be something to be really, really good to check out. So we'll also put that link up on our site or on Facebook so people can check that out as well. So we also have a listener question tonight. And somebody, interestingly enough, we're kind of saying this mental health thing here, but a listener wants to know, how do they talk about being diagnosed with a mental illness? This particular person was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and they want to know, how do you go about dating after you've been diagnosed with this, and how do you tell your dates, and how do you broach the subject? So we'll talk a little bit about that. And in our last segment, we're going to talk about using adversity and how you can use adversity to overcome your problems. And we'll talk a little bit about some stuff that's been in the news media with the Kardashians and the Odoms this week, and that's what actually sparked me thinking about this, because, apparently they're Khloe Kardashian, I think, is her name, and she was married to the basketball player Lamar Odom. And when he had his episode I think he almost overdosed on drugs, they stopped their divorce proceedings. So we're going to talk a little bit about how adversity can kind of sometimes possibly help you overcome the problems you might have in your marriage, or make it worse.
Yeah, or at least, if nothing else, at least inspire you to try to overcome them where you may have given up previously. Doesn't mean that you necessarily will overcome them.
I
think there are a lot bigger challenges there, and we'll get to it when we get into that segment, third segment, because I know you had forwarded not the Khloe Kardashian Lamar Odom article, though I did look at that one too, but another article about someone. And I, my first impression was, girl, you're still going to be in for a world of hurt. So
yeah, and I wanted to kind of talk about, the possibilities of when maybe it's not necessarily a good idea, when maybe you're not doing it for, the reasons that maybe everybody thinks you are. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we get in there.
But before we do that, we don't want our bacon to burn.
No, so, we don't.
So before we hop into the listener question, you had found this online, and Oscar Mayer, yes, the makers of not very good bacon, but, you know, something.
Acceptable bacon.
Acceptable
we
bacon.
We did eat
I'm
some
sure.
of that this weekend.
Possibly. I didn't make the one that you bought.
You did not. So where did that go?
It's still in the fridge.
Oh.
We have another party.
Bacon
snob. So we have an annual gin and bacon party, which we just had this past week.
Bacon snob.
I had made enough bacon. Good bacon. Right bacon. Actually, Right Bacon is the right bacon. That they're not a sponsor of the show, but they should be. anyway, so yeah, we had a big gin and bacon party this year like we always do. And yes, I did not make any Oscar Mayer bacon. I used the better stuff that's a little bit more expensive, but boy, is it so good. But while we were looking around, I imagine were you looking for bacon recipes?
I was looking for bacon recipes.
And she came across this link that lets us know that Oscar Mayer, the makers of bacon, have their own dating application, dating app.
Yes.
It's called Sizzle, Find Your Bacon Lover. It's a real dating app for bacon lovers, so you can connect with thousands of like-minded lovers who share your selective taste in bacon that's cured for 12 hours and smoke-housed for another 12. And I'm wondering if it'll help you find bacon lovers rather than just Oscar Mayer bacon eaters, because I think there's a clear difference, and I hope that their application does not restrict bacon lovers to just Oscar Mayer bacon people.
Well, I'm sure that they're probably open to all types of bacon. They're
I don't think that, you know, Catholics are allowed on J-Date, right? So, I mean, it's
Well, how are they going to know? For reals. They going to know? Are they going to sneak in and look in your refrigerator to make sure you only have Oscar Mayer bacon? I think not.
Well, anyway, so I think it's kind of funny. Fun that they have it. I can't imagine it being a serious dating app, but hey, you never know. They have it. Go check it out. OscarMayer.com/find-bacon-love.
Well, you know what I thought was great was I was like, okay, so if Steve had ever done online dating, this would have been his app. You totally would have done the Bacon Lover app.
I've never done it, but you know, I probably would not.
You would have done it. You'd have totally done it. Somebody would have made you do it.
Yeah, that's true.
Somebody would have signed you up.
They would have signed me up. I would have started getting the emails and...
Yeah, and I don't know if you swipe right or swipe left or whatever with it, but if you guys have an opportunity and you want to have a little fun, just go out there and check it out and you might meet your perfect bacon soulmate. You might meet your perfect bacon soulmate. So check it out.
Pun intended.
And with that.
And of course, just this week, they announced that bacon, along with a whole bunch of other kinds of meats, are going to be considered carcinogens by the World Health Organization.
I'm pretty sure the World Health Organization just doesn't want people to eat, period.
Exactly.
Just stop eating everything.
Stop eating
Eat grass. Oh, no, it might have pesticides on.
That's right. You, there's nothing you can do. Just may as well just die now if you want to live a long life.
Yeah, because everything is going to make you sick or give you cancer, apparently. So,
anyway.
But yeah.
Everything in moderation, folks. So let's get to our listener question,
shall we? Can you read that off for me?
I will read it. So the listener asks, I was just diagnosed bipolar, and I am worried that will ruin my chances with dating. Will a woman be able to accept me with this illness, and when, how do I tell someone I have it? Also, at one point, I ruined my credit because of this issue. I'm getting back on my feet, but how can I explain what happened and prove it won't happen again?
Yeah, this is a really, really good question because I think there's probably a lot of people out there that, you know, if you don't have bipolar, maybe you have depression or you have something else. And there's still, even though we've done a lot of work in the mental health field, there's still somewhat of a stigma.
So help us out with bipolar. Is that manic depressive?
Yes, bipolar is the new word for manic depressive.
Okay, so those of you. Sometimes you're super happy, exuberant, and sometimes you're very
super,
depressed.
Super
and you
depressed.
Have these
yes.
mood swings back and forth, and sometimes the swings can last days, weeks?
Weeks, sometimes months, depending on if you're a rapid cycler or a slow cycler, as they call it. I can't remember exactly off the top of my head what the time frames are for those cycles. But I'm thinking if you're going within days and weeks, you're a rapid cycler.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times, you know, he mentions that he ruined his credit. A lot of times someone who's in a manic phase, they'll stay up for days. They'll clean their house like a fiend. It's almost like being on a drug. It's almost like being on a stimulant. And you're just constantly going, 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 going. And a lot of times it's like, you know, you're buying stuff off of QVC and you're going on these crazy shopping trips and, oh my God, I should go buy a Mercedes. And the next thing you know, you've maxed out all your credit cards, you can't pay your mortgage, and it's a mess. And it's probably what happened here. He went on spending sprees when he was, you know, in his manic phase. And then you hit the depressive phase, which, again, you're really super depressed. You can barely get out of bed. You might lose your job. You stop paying your bills. Maybe you stop bathing. You know, it's a pretty big deal. So if you're going to date, you know, if you're going to, you know, be dating, at some point you do need to tell somebody that this is an issue going on. Now, it is controllable with meds. But the thing about a lot of times people that are taking medication, what happens normally with medications is when you start feeling better, what do? You stop taking them.
Right. And I would also have to think that if it levels you out, to some people, especially, you know, you may not like the depressive side, but you may really like the manic side.
Yeah.
And you may feel like you've been zombified, you know,
right,
or dulled down. So you may be resistant to taking that med long term.
Absolutely. And that does happen with a lot of people. Some people don't like the way it makes them feel. They don't like the side effects. And it depends. I mean, the old treatment for manic depressive or bipolar was lithium.
Okay.
And lithium gave people the shakes. So a lot of times you would see people and they would have a really hard time writing. And these were not people that had Parkinson's or anything like that. These were people a lot of times that were taking lithium. And it just kind of was pervasive and it just kind of just always made you shake. So they actually referred to it as the lithium shake because you would see people with it and you would know that that was what was going on.
So that's why they didn't want to serve me at Friendly's. Okay.
Yes.
I was asking for the wrong shake.
So if you have found yourself, whether it's bipolar disorder or some other kind of mood disorder or depression or whatever, you at some point dating someone do need to tell them. However, you probably want to wait until you know that this is somebody that you want to continue seeing on a long-term exclusive basis. I wouldn't say you walk this out there to everybody because everybody's not going to be on a need-to-know basis. If you go on a first date with somebody, you don't have to tell them your whole life story in that first date because that first date might not lead to a second one. So you don't have to necessarily trot this out there. When I was dating, I didn't tell everybody, you know, that I had been a child of an alcoholic or whatever on the first date. You know, just, you don't, you, I just didn't go there because that's, you don't need to know that about me yet. You know, you just need to know if you want to have a second date with me at this point. And then once you've seen somebody for a while and you're thinking, okay, I really want to continue to see this person, then you can sit down and say, okay, here's something that I have. Another time, you know, if you haven't gotten to that point yet, but you begin to have symptoms, you know, you're beginning to maybe go into a manic or maybe a depressive phase, that might be another good time. You know, we've only been dating for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever, but I think I'm about to go through a manic phase or whatever, or I'm feeling a little manicky. I need to have this conversation with you. So that's another good time to have the conversation. You don't have to have it, like I said, on the first date. But you do need to have it at some point, especially if you're wanting this person to be in your life. And you're expecting this person to be in your life. As far as the credit, again, you don't have to tell people your credit score on the first date. But if you're planning on having this person in your life for a while and you have some credit issues and you have some issues with money, yeah, you're probably going to need to have that conversation because that's a need-to-know basis at that point. But somebody you've just gone on a couple of dates with that you're not even sure if they're going to be around next month, these things they don't need to know. Because, you know, they don't need to know until they're a part of your life.
So. Yeah, I think one part of the question, though, there is, will a woman be able to accept me with this illness? And there's no knowing. I mean, someone who had a bad experience with someone who was on that may be less likely to put up with it than someone who really hasn't run into it before. And so they may not really completely understand what it is that they're getting to. And obviously, you can explain it and they can go online and read about it. And some people are just going to have more of a tolerance, a risk tolerance than other people, and really you can't do anything about that. And so that's always going to be a risk. But we all face those risks of something that the longer someone gets to know us, they may decide that, you know what, you're not the right person for me. It doesn't matter whether it be a mental health issue or a snoring issue, or, I mean, it could be any number of things that, you know, people are in relationships for 2 years before they decide they're not right for each other. I mean, that happens all the time. So, it's just a risk that we take when we date. So,
there absolutely are people out there that will look at this and go, "Hey, you too, I've got it too." Or, "Hey, you know what? That doesn't scare me off. You know, you've got both sides of the spectrum." I think it's just finding someone who's okay and that understands that it's something that can be controlled with medication and is willing to give it a go. But there's definitely people out there that will. So I don't think it should be, please don't put it in your mind that someone's never going to be able to accept you for it.
Right.
All right. So with that, I think we're ready for our next segment. We'll have to take a little break here and pay some bills. But when we come back, we're going to have Dr. Robert Shug with us, and we're going to talk about how to recognize a psychopath or sociopath before you get into a relationship with one. So don't go away. You're listening to
Mod Love.
Hi, Jody here from Mod Love. I hope you guys are enjoying the show. I just wanted to remind you all to visit our website at modloveradio.com. You'll notice that on our homepage on the right-hand side, there's a blue box. If you put your information in there, we will send you some free goodies. And while you're there, you can also watch videos, listen to episodes, subscribe to the show, or even check out our gallery of expert guests. You can also search for articles and send us your questions. Again, that web address is modloveradio.com. Thanks so much for tuning in, and thanks for listening to Mod Love.
My boots on my feet off the ground. Rum and my coffee, it's warm going down. You, this coffee, and the rain. Yeah, it's just you, this coffee and the rain.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Jody Riley with my co-host Stephen Cardinal, and you're listening to Mod Love. And as promised, we have a fantastic guest with us tonight, Dr. Robert Shug. And he is a forensic psychology and criminal justice professor, and he's working out of California State, out of Long Beach, and he has graciously been, you know, available to us today to talk a little bit about what we've been talking about in some of the previous shows about psychopathology and kind of how you can determine if you're dating somebody, if you might be possibly dating a psychopath, and how to kind of get out of that. So thank you so much, Dr. Shug. Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, I usually say, I tell people Shug like Shug Knight, and then they immediately recognize it and can pronounce it.
I was thinking Shug from The Color Purple, but there you go, Shug Knight.
Yeah,
works.
I think it's the same pronunciation, yeah. People have been butchering my name my entire life, so.
Yeah, nobody can spell my name, so I totally get it. Well, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me, Jody.
Before we get started too much, so tell us a little bit about what you do. You're a professor of criminal justice, and you do forensic psychology, which is kind of like, originally, where I really wanted to go with my career was forensic psychology, and I wound up kind of in clinical psychology because I didn't want to go the criminal justice route, and I think you kind of have to go the criminal justice route to get there. But so tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, I mean, at California State, I am I'm an assistant professor, and so I teach the course, and I'm in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice, so I teach the courses more focused on forensic psychology and correctional psychology in the areas where criminal justice and psychology intersect. In addition to that, I do research. We're required to as at the Cal State system. So I do research on things related to mental illness and criminal behavior, and I have my own lab here on campus, and we look at more of the neuroscience aspects of that. My original PhD was in psychology, but it was more focused on the clinical neurosciences, so how the brain functions and relating brain functioning and structure to criminal behavior. That's kind of my thing. And then what I did is that, if that wasn't enough, the masochist in me went back and retrained as a clinical psychologist as well. So I'm wrapping that up right now with the focus on sort of forensic assessment and that kind of thing. But it all kind of ties together and definitely transitions very easily into the classroom. It's a topic that folks are just really seem to not be able to get enough of, as you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm getting constant questions.
Right, right. And so I think it's because, it's kind of a timely sort of sexy topic as the media, you know, rolls out different television shows and movies and whatnot. It's certainly timely in terms of what we see in current events and the shootings and whatnot, and people wanting answers, wanting to understand. I think with sort of the focus today with relationships, it's certainly something we can all understand. Hopefully, most of us have not been in relationships with psychopaths, but most of us will come across them in our lifetimes. So in that respect, it becomes very relevant and something people just, they just want to know more about.
Yeah, amen to that. So speaking of that, can you give us a little bit of a definition of what a psychopath is, and also maybe a little a difference between a psychopath and a sociopath? Because I know even in the professional language, psychopath and sociopath is actually almost used interchangeably, but they are slightly different. And I've always kind of gone with the Dr. Hare, the way he differentiated between the two. But give us what your definition and your difference is.
Right. So one, I think one of the problems in this field is the confusion with the terminology, and this reflects improper use, you know, and just folks not having the right knowledge about it. And then I think the evolution of terminology over the years contributes to that confusion. And so psychopathy it's a personality disorder, and it's something that you're basically born with, you know, starts early in life and lasts throughout the lifespan. It's not something you catch. It's something you're sort of wired to have. And it doesn't seem to go away, although we're still learning more about that through research. And so these are folks who really just lack empathy and remorse and understanding of emotions within themselves and others. And it's thought that they... I'm going to wait for the plane to go by. Does the plane come up, by the way?
No, I'm not hearing the plane at all.
Okay. Give it 1 second. So it's a personality disorder, and these folks are often characterized by antisocial and impulsive behavior. Not always, though. And they're generally not stupid, meaning that they have intact intelligence, generally average to above average intelligence, but don't seem to be able to learn from their mistakes.
You know, and that's a really good point. And I think what I found with a lot of people who sometimes kind of find themselves involved with somebody who pretty much probably clinically is a psychopath, they want to help. They want to help them get better. And even in clinical work, it is very, very difficult, if almost impossible, for psychopaths sometimes to change. Because like you said, it's the way they're wired, and there's not really a lot of treatment to help it.
That's right. And actually, it's somewhat contraindicated. And there were some studies out of Canada, I believe from the late 70s, early 80s, they were collecting data on a new program up there where they used these innovative approaches, and it turned out that it actually made the psychopathic patients worse, meaning it made them better psychopaths. And
I was going to say, was that the one from the prisons where they were working with them in prisons? And
that's right. And, yes. And the treatment was a little unusual. If you look back at it now, it involved hot tubs and using drugs that weren't necessarily, you know, what we would consider the drugs we would use today. But still, the idea that, and if you listen to some of the information that's come out of those studies, there's interviews available from folks that were enrolled in those, that how, you know, sitting around with other psychopaths and learning how to press other people's buttons and learning the jargon that the clinicians use and just becoming better manipulators. It doesn't make sense logically that psychopaths would be able to do that. And so really doesn't seem to be much that works, although there is, I think, more studies, initial studies anyway, coming out that, you know, targeting with treatment specific aspects of psychopathy that may be promising, although by and large, nothing really seems to work, you know, as of now, to date. We still need to replicate these studies and find new techniques.
Yeah, I mean, you can, if there's psychopathology along with depression or something, yeah, you can treat someone for depression, but personality disorders are not, you can't treat them with meds. And I think that's where a lot of people get very frustrated, because it's not something that a medicine can fix.
It's really tough. Yeah, you can't just throw pills at it, right? So, and even talk therapies are tough too. And I always tell folks, you know, generally with psychotherapy, the patient is vested in the outcome. They've come to you as a clinician wanting to get better, wanting to feel the way they used to and be normal again and whatnot. And or, you know, maybe it might be court-ordered sort of therapy where they have to go, but they're at least vested in it. Whereas with personality disorders in general, and psychopathy in particular, these folks are not motivated to do treatment. They don't think anything's really wrong with them. And in fact, they think, you know, the people around them are
right,
sort of screwed up. So getting that person into therapy is really difficult anyway. And, you know, a psychopath, we might even make the argument that they probably would know better than wanting to go into therapy unless they had to for some other purpose, you know.
Now, there is a slight difference between a psychopath and a sociopath. And like I said, I had always kind of gone, I think it's Dr. Hare, and I'm forgetting his first name, who wrote a lot about this. And I think he kind of went along the path that a sociopath is made and a psychopath is born.
Well, yeah, Robert Hare actually studied the work of Hervey Cleckley, who was the first guy who kind of put psychopathy on the map. But to backtrack a little bit, and my view is a little bit different, but it's based more in what's available in research. And this is all covered, actually, in my book, Mental Illness and Crime, on Sage, if you don't mind me plugging my book.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, we'll put it up on our page, so if people want to go check it out, they can do that.
I really do. I appreciate that. So the term sociopathy was originally introduced in the early 1900s by a guy named Carl Birnbaum, and he was talking about a disorder that was attributed to societal forces, societal influences. And basically what happened is throughout the 1900s, particularly in the middle of the 1900s, the sociologists came on the scene in criminology and really started pushing the social explanations for crime. And we saw this across disciplines. There were social explanations for behaviors of all sorts. And so that term sociopathy kind of stuck, and as the DSM formed and reformed and revised, various sort of incarnations of that term were applied at different times and not at others. The problem, I think, came when folks proposed that there was a difference, at least in terms of the etiology. And so a guy named David Licken, depending on how you pronounce it, in his book called The Antisocial Personalities, proposed a distinction between sociopathy and psychopathy, and that sociopathy was basically due to bad parenting and societal forces and whatnot, and psychopathy was more driven by biological influences. Now, there was no data to support this at the time, and he even admitted himself in the book that he was just sort of opining, you know, and theorizing.
Yeah.
I think the problem came that people kind of grabbed onto that, and as you know, I'm sure clinicians in the field, I hear clinicians use the term sociopathy all the time, and actually psychopathy is quite rare. The problem that I and my position is we should not use the term sociopathy. And here's why. First of all, the research actually shows that in most behavior, and certainly in personality disorders, that's a combination of biological and social influences, and that you probably won't find a disorder that is caused purely by social factors or purely by biology, right? We know there's an interaction between the two. Second, and more importantly, is there is no empirically validated way to assess for sociopathy. With psychopathy, we have Robert Hare's psychopathy checklist, which has been developed over, you know, decades. And
yeah, you can even find that online.
What's that?
You can even find it online.
Yeah, you can. Now Robert Hare, to be fair, designed it for clinicians to use. It's not something that he thought that sort of the general public should be using. Even though I think it's a good idea for the general public to understand the items in the psychopathy checklist, but in terms of making diagnosis, that's something that a trained professional needs to do. So we have the psychopathy checklist, and it's a very thorough assessment process that involves, you know, clinical interview and lots of file record review. With sociopathy, we have nothing like that. And folks have used things like the MMPI, or they've used other instruments that have inferred this thing called, you know, this idea of sociopathy, but no one's ever really empirically defined it or captured a way to measure it. And so that's my position, is that until we do that, and I think it's an interesting idea, actually, to distinguish between, you know, a psychopath and a sociopath based on what was involved in the formation of the disorder, right?
Mm-hmm.
But until we're able to measure sociopathy like we can measure psychopathy, I think we shouldn't even be bringing the term up. I think we need to operationalize it and test it and then have a really good understanding of what we think it is. Third point, actually, that I've often brought up with psychopathy researchers is, If you sit a sociopath and a psychopath down in front of you, are you going to be able to tell the difference? And I assert, no, you won't. And so I think, you know, we can use science to, if we're going to make a distinction between the two, I think we should understand why we want to make that distinction. I mean, how does it help in terms of treatment or in terms of management, right? But then we need to measure it properly. And so far, we just don't. And that's where I stand.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because you definitely want it to be something that's more scientific-based. And kind of along that lines, because if you're just a regular person out there kind of in the dating world, there are a couple things to keep in mind is that, you know, psychopathology is not very common, but it's more common than people think. And it's not just men sitting in prison that are serial killers and whatever. There are a lot of people out there that have these personality disorders that they function in the world. They're not criminals. And okay. So if you've got somebody out there who's dating and they've, you know, they're kind of worried about, kind of worried about running into these kinds of people, because I've been hearing from matchmakers and other dating coaches. I do a lot of dating coaching myself, and I hear from them that because, like you said, a lot of these psychopaths can be very intelligent. Sometimes a lot of them are very successful and wealthy as well, and they will seek out matchmakers and dating coaches and stuff to help them with their personal relationships, because, you know, this personality disorder is not, you know, do very well if you're trying to have personal relationships. So what are some of the big red flags that people can maybe look for if they've met somebody that they think might be a psychopath, or even if you're like a matchmaker or a dating coach, what are some things to look for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, just kind of looking at the traits of psychopathy that Robert Hare outlined in the psychopathy checklist, I mean, the things that would probably raise red flags in any relationship in terms of, you know, is the person, are they promiscuous? I mean, I think that's probably one of the things that comes up more often than not. So promiscuity, are they responsible? Can you depend on them? Are they coming home at night, you know, on a regular basis if it's, you know, a committed relationship or whatnot? Are they treating you well? I mean, is this a person that's overly, you know, are they grandiose and narcissistic? Are they empathetic? Do they, you know, appreciate your emotional experiences and validate them and whatnot. I think in terms of communication, you know, psychopaths, if we're going into the assumption that they're glib and superficially charming, which is the first item on the psychopathy checklist, you know, they're very well spoken, they have the gift of gab, and so I think that's a quality that sort of is able to rope potential partners and even victims in, you know, bring them closer. If the psychopaths looked and acted like monsters, they would not have access to victims, as they seem to be able to quite readily. Right?
Absolutely. And they're such good mimics that even if they don't have the capacity for some of these emotions, they can mimic them very well, and they can come off as very, very charming and very engaging.
Right, right. And so back to red flags, I think the red flag that you would expect to see in any relationship, and I think probably compounded by perhaps, you know, patterns of these things. So people make mistakes. They make mistakes in relationships, and they make mistakes in their lives. And so we certainly don't want to go around overly paranoid and kind of worried that, you know, if somebody makes a mistake in a relationship that they are a psychopath, right? But if these mistakes keep happening over and over again, and just like in any probably relationship with a normal person, you know, deciding on whether or not you want to continue that relationship. Now, I think what I've heard from colleagues in more the dating and treatment realm is that, you know, when the relationship becomes manipulative, and when the relationship is unhealthy, and maybe perhaps a person's, you know, bank account is being drained, or you know, being berated or feeling controlled and isolated. Now that becomes a problem, whether or not the person is a psychopath.
Right.
If they are a psychopath, then I think that there are courses of action that an individual should take once they identify that they're in that situation.
And so what are some of those resources, and what are some of those courses that you would kind of recommend? Because I know you used to have your own radio show called Aftermath Radio, where you talked a lot about these issues. And I think you even had some resources for people that were maybe survivors of these kind of relationships.
Aftermath Radio was an extension of the Aftermath Surviving Psychopathy Foundation, which is still in existence, and I'm on the board of directors, and it's a really great place for folks to just get information. I think, let me just kind of go through, I think, a good course of action for folks who find themselves involved in a relationship with a psychopath. You know, first, I think, you know, knowledge and education is so important, right? Knowledge is power. So, and we've often found how survivors of these relationships are able to, nowadays with the internet, you know, certainly it's much easier to get information. So know what you're dealing with, right? Now there's good information on the internet and there's bogus information, so that can be challenging sorting through that. But understand, I know in my classes when I'm teaching about psychopathy and talking about the different traits of a psychopath, you will see the light bulbs go on in students, and they're like, "Oh my God, I know this person. I'm dating this person, or this is my sibling, or uncle, or whatever." Right, and so people can recognize it once they see the diagnostic criteria. But we have to, raise awareness about that. And, there are folks that are doing that. And the Aftermath Foundation is trying to do that as well. So, but knowledge and education, right? That's the first thing. I think the second thing is support, right? So reaching out to other folks who are in a similar situation. And, in treatment, that's something we encourage anyway, normalizing your experience. Because when you feel alone and isolated about anything, depression, anxiety, especially with when you're dealing with a psychopath who might be isolating you from your family and your friends, knowing that there are other people who share your same experience or similar experiences can be tremendously helpful and therapeutic, right? And so,
oh yeah,
plugging into resources and joining, groups or even with Aftermath, there are chat rooms and whatnot, being able to reach out to other folks, just normalizing the experience and having social support, I think it's critical. And the last thing I think, and perhaps this should be the most, in terms of priority, should be the first, is protection, right? And so you don't want to be in a place where your physical safety is being jeopardized. And so all of the experts that I've ever talked to on the Aftermath radio show have talked about, A, no contact, and B, document, and those two things always come up. So if you can, if it's at all possible, stop contact with the psychopathic individual. Sometimes that's not possible, but to the degree that you can do that, certainly that is that should be a priority. And also documenting everything, because oftentimes things will go into litigation or even the criminal justice system, and you want to make sure you have all your ducks in a row and are able to articulate yourself when needed so that you can make the case as a survivor.
Yeah, so absolutely. Well, I was going to say too, is that I think that no contact sometimes is the toughest part, because especially when you've been manipulated and isolated and this person has been your only resource for emotional outlet and such as that, and has been your lover and your friend, and you having that no contact, I think sometimes is the toughest thing for most people.
That's right. I mean, and everyone think back maybe to a breakup of a relationship, and when the person starts texting you again, and how you're able to perhaps not reply, and but eventually, after 100 texts, if you do reply, well, then that person has learned that you eventually will, and so it becomes even harder, right? So. And in hindsight, I think it's very normal for us to look back, even on a bad relationship, and sort of remember the good things, and the bad things kind of fade away a little bit. And so change is tough, and getting out of a relationship that you thought was everything you wanted and needed and turned out not to be is it's a horrible thing to go through. But the no contact is sort of a hard and fast kind of black and white thing that we can do. It's an easy rule to follow. If the one rule is don't talk to this person ever again, that's pretty easy. But if we start saying, well, you can talk to them in these situations and under these conditions, then that just makes it harder.
Yeah.
And psychopaths are able to prey on weakness and manipulate, and we know this. So.
Oh, God, yeah. So really quick, before we have to end this here, tell us about your book again, and where can we get it so that we can put it out on the website for people?
Right. Well, it's a textbook. As being a professor, they require us to write things and publish.
Yes.
And
so. You have to publish. publish.
So this is a textbook called Mental Illness and Crime. It's by myself and a guy called Dr. Henry Fridella. And basically, it's on Sage Publications, and you can get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and pretty much everywhere that you get books in general. It's a great book, and there's definitely a chapter devoted to personality disorders and psychopathy, but I actually go through each of the other major classes of mental disorders and talk about, in the literature, the relationships with crime and violence. So if things like psychopathy and personality disorders interest you, there's certainly plenty of that. But then things like schizophrenia or mood disorders, or and now the big thing is with sort of the autistic spectrum disorders and how, you know, these may relate to crime and violence. So there's a lot in there. I use it in all my classes. I make all my students buy it. I don't know if that's ethical, but I do it.
They need to know. They need to know what they're getting into.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much for being willing to come on and chat with us about this today, because I think, like you said, in the media, it has become something that that a lot of people are talking about, and there's a lot of confusion out there. And I'm glad that we, you know, that there's some resources out there for people that if they are survivors and they, like you said, if the light bulb goes on, they're reading stuff or they're hearing stuff and the light bulb goes on, that there's resources out there for them to be able to you know, to get some help if they need it. And you know, just to be able to survive this and maybe even recognize it before you actually get into a really long-term relationship with somebody that might have these tendencies. Because if you can see it coming, you know, especially if you've come out of it before and you can see it coming, then you're a lot better off if you don't get into it in the first place.
That's right. That's great advice. And there's several great resources. Robert Hare's book, Without Conscience, is, I think, should be on everyone's bookshelf. I really do. But, and it's got a chapter on practical things to do when you find yourself in a relationship with a psychopath. Aftermath, Surviving Psychopathy Foundation, find them on the internet. And if anyone wants to reach out to me through the university, feel free to send me an email too. I can answer questions as well.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much again, Dr. Shug. We do appreciate it. And we look forward to hearing more from you.
Thanks, Jody. Thanks for having me on.
All right, thanks. And guys, we're going to have to take a quick little break. When we come back, we're going to be jumping into our third segment here. So don't go away. You are listening to Mod Love.
This is Stephen Cardinal of Mod Love, and if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to head out to iTunes and leave us a review. Doing so will really help us reach more people and touch more lives. And if you're not an iTunes user, even a review on our Facebook page will go a long way in showing your support. Thanks a lot, and thanks for listening to Mod Love.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Jody Riley with my co-host,
Stephen Cardinal.
And you are listening to
Mod Love.
And if you are just joining us, we are now in our third segment. And you just missed a fantastic second segment with Dr. Robert Shug, who talked to us a little bit about psychopaths and sociopaths. And gave us some ways that we can recognize them before we're in a relationship with us, and gave us, you know, some interesting tidbits there about it. And as I was speaking to him, I kept wondering how many people are going to be sitting there listening to this, and light bulbs are going to go on. Oh my God, that was what the problem was, or oh my God, am I a psychopath? you start to have those thoughts.
Probably fewer of the latter. I would.
Yes. Yes. Way. I don't know. You never know, though. Some people, you know, they're hypochondriacs. They have everything. And so, yeah. Well, let me just have that personality disorder.
That's
today,
true.
Too.
That's
yeah.
True. I'll tack that one on.
Yeah. So, and I, you know, I found it was just fascinating that he actually does work and does research with psychopaths. And it's not an easy population to study. So good for him. And we thank him very much for being on and kind of helping us out with that. So now, as promised, we're going to talk about in our third segment about overcoming adversity. I mean, or kind of overcoming your problems in your relationship as a result of going through some type of adversity. And as I mentioned, I think in the first segment, what kind of triggered me to start thinking about this was the story about Khloe Kardashian and her husband, or the husband that she was estranged from. They were actually in divorce proceedings. They were just, their divorce papers were on the judge's desk to be signed.
And they were just, yeah, they're just waiting, had to be processed. And so my understanding from this little bit, and I am not a Kardashian follower.
Yeah, and I'm not either,
anyway.
So, yeah.
But from what I understand, so they'd been married, they were going through a divorce. Mostly, by the sounds of it, related to his drug and or alcohol use. He needed to go through some recovery, and he had not accepted that. So they're going through the divorce. Well, now that he hit this really bad turn in his life with this whole prostitution, drug use, heart attack, whatever it was that he had there, he now realizes he has to go through a program.
Sounds like he hit his bottom.
Hit the bottom. And so now they're saying, you know what, now that he's finally recognized this, the reason for breaking up, you know, she's wanted him to do this for 2 years, and now he's kind of forced to do it. Let's take the divorce off the table. Now, hitting bottom in this way and being forced to go through it isn't necessarily the same thing as choosing to go through it.
True.
Now, I certainly hope that this guy is able to use this process and get the recovery. No one wants this guy to be stuck in this hell of, you know, drug and alcohol abuse, whatever the exact details are. But I don't know that we know from this instance that he's necessarily in his mind truly ready to do it as much as, I woke up a few days later in a hospital and they're telling me I have to do this.
Well, and I think
there's a struggle still
ahead. When you look at drug addiction and alcohol addiction, more times than not, that's the only thing that makes the addict go into recovery. Yes, there are some times that people just, you know, oh, everybody around me is really upset. And some people's bottom is a lot different. But generally, you have to reach a point where it is no longer tolerable for me to live this way and I have to get into recovery. So his bottom obviously was drug overdose in a brothel in Nevada and winding up, you know, in the hospital in a coma. That bottom is a very extreme bottom.
Right.
But it's interesting that this triggered her to want to put the divorce on hold and let's see if we can get you healthy and maybe work on our marriage. And it was the adversity, this big extreme hardcore thing that happened to him that actually triggered her to go back and go, okay, let's maybe give this a try. If you're willing to get yourself some help and do this, then I'll stick in here and stay married. And so sometimes it's those things that happen like that that actually take the other partner, maybe who, like in her case, had just said, thrown up her hands and gone, you know, I'm done. It actually triggered her to go back and go, okay, let's give this one more chance if you go into recovery and do the things that you need to do to get healthy.
Sure.
You know, so that's kind of that thing where we talked about before. There's no incentive. You know, if you're constantly, you know, not willing to leave and not willing to do the things that you need to do to make this addict or whatever realize that they need to get help. In this case, she had done that. And the hitting bottom and him going into treatment now made her say, okay, if you follow your end of the bargain, then I'll stick around and be here and we'll stay married. Right. So it'll be interesting to see how it kind of shakes out to see if he really does get help and really does get his life together and they stay together.
Right. But they're not the only example of this type of situation.
No. And the second example that we're going to talk about is way different.
Yes. So this is, we got this from The Mirror, so UK newspaper or online paper at least. And this is about a woman whose husband cheated on her, left and ended up leaving her for a younger woman. And she was devastated, of course. And then I guess as they were going through the proceedings and whatnot, he had a car accident. And
yes,
that shook him up to the point where he came back hat in hand, begged for forgiveness and to be taken back. And she took him back, much to the chagrin and displeasure of her family.
Because he had left her.
Right.
He had left her. He had left her for his mistress, moved in with his mistress, left her with three children, alone by herself, to raise three kids, and had moved in with his mistress. And then he has a car accident. And the way her family saw it was, he's coming crawling back to you now that he's had a car accident. And in this instance, the adversity of him cheating and then him having the car accident, she took him back to work on the issues. But when you kind of read a little deeper what happened afterwards, she'd made a lot of cosmetic changes to herself. And when I say cosmetic, I mean literally cosmetic. She got a boob job and everything to try to keep him. And it doesn't sound like they really...
Well, no, that was one of the things he did. So he came back and I think his guilt, she's always wanted one.
Mm-hmm.
Part of his guilt said, I'm going to pay for that now. So he ended up paying for the boob job. So that was after he came back.
Right. So she kind of did this stuff But what was interesting is, unlike what, you know, the Kardashians and the Odoms are doing, and they're going into treatment and they're getting help or whatever, these guys seem to not do quite that much. They seem to just, okay, well, you cheated and it was a bad thing, and we're going to, rather than looking at their marriage and really digging in, it didn't really talk about them doing that very much.
Right. He actually, where is it in here? He said, you know, he doesn't actually have remorse for his cheating. He says, I don't regret having an affair, as it's made our relationship stronger. Looking back, I think I was having an early midlife crisis, but Karen's the love of my life, and we're happier now than ever.
So he had a little bit of a revelation then, maybe.
Possibly.
He did do the classic midlife crisis stuff. He bought a sports car, and he got a mistress, and he took a studio apartment, you know, and you know, did the whole nine yards. But perhaps his car accident, you know, kind of like, you know, Lamar Odom's drug overdose, kicked him back into reality of, wait, this, I really want this. This is what I really want. So it's very interesting, though, but it didn't really tell you if they went through therapy. It didn't talk about that. But I would think that if you're coming from something like that, you probably need to process it with a therapist or a coach or a relationship expert. You probably need to process what happened, because it's very difficult to do that on your own.
Right. It just, you know, for me reading it, and again, mirror.co.uk, you can find it, Husband's Affair Saved Marriage Mom. And again, we're getting this newspaper's slant on it.
Right,
I'm sure they're saying all sorts of things that aren't in here. And UK tabloids and newspapers, they tend to be like the New York Post and stuff. So there's certainly room for, errors in here. But at least the things that they included in there, it strikes me as she didn't want to say goodbye. She had this dream of a perfect life, and having him come back meant that maybe she could still have it. And like you said, I don't know that they've processed the actual issues there. And I don't know that he's necessarily fully processed his issues, and that he's not going to go back and cheat again once the guilt has worn off and the bloom of, you know, this brand new relationship kind of wears off, and he's back to exactly the way they were before, which was him not being very happy in that and looking for a little extra adventure.
Yeah. Right. I think you're absolutely right. And it doesn't really tell us what work they did on it, but just going off what we have here in this particular article, they didn't seem to really do a lot of work on it. And I think when you're coming from something, you know, a betrayal like cheating or something like that, you have to process that. That's not something you can just shove under the rug. You can't. I mean, what was the other basketball player that cheated on his wife?
Oh, mine. You're going to need a longer.
LeBron gave his wife a huge, huge diamond ring. And everybody's like, oh, that was, you know, a present for his cheating or whatever. You know, he gave her a big old diamond ring and she took him back. I think most women are not going to just say, hey, get me a boob job or a diamond ring and I'll take you back. I don't think that's going to work for most women. I think most women are going to need a little bit more processing than
right,
that.
Right. And, you know, she's saying that, you know, he came back, he gave her, took her out for a really nice dinner, and she said it was just perfect. He was apologizing and crying for all the hurt, and to see him so upset really hit him. He was usually such a joker. A few days later, they had a 2-week family holidays to somewhere, and then when they came back, he gave Karen the present that she's always wanted, a 4,500-pound boob job. 4,500 pounds being money units in the UK and not the weight of the boobs, I'm assuming.
Because that would make her, yeah, that would be wrong.
You know, and it's just, there's just so much there to me that just screams, this is not a good idea.
He just glossed right over it. He just
bought you with, you know, he played you is the way I see it.
Right.
I have no idea. I hope that's not true. I would prefer to be wrong than right in this case, but you know, at least reading what I read there.
So there's a right way to do it, and then there's a way to do it that maybe not necessarily wrong, but really isn't going to address the core issues. And I think if you're gonna take somebody back after something like this, and you're going to use the adversity, you have to address the core issues that caused it. And in his case, he's going to have to address whatever was happening with him for the midlife crisis. They're going to have to address whatever was going on in the relationship, because affairs and things like that are symptoms. They're symptoms. You know, maybe sometimes it's a personality of that person and they gloss over everything by having affairs or whatever. But generally, affairs are symptoms of something bigger, whether it's just bigger with him or it's bigger with them as a couple, which I suspect it probably is. They're both going to need to process it and deal with the core issues of what actually went on behind the cheating. Because otherwise, they're just going to be right back here 6 months to a year, however long it takes the honeymoon phase to wear off this time, they're going to be right back in the same spot, I think.
I'm afraid that you're probably right.
But you can absolutely use these types of things to kind of, you know, almost, you know, what do they call it? Excise the wound. I mean, sure. You can use these things to bring to the top and bring to the surface all the stuff you've been burying down. You know, maybe it's the passive aggressive stuff you do in your marriage as a couple, or maybe it's the fact that you really hate him because he doesn't have a better job, or you really hate her because, you know, she's a terrible housekeeper, whatever all this stuff might be bubbling underneath. Sometimes it's these things like having an affair or maybe having a bankruptcy or something like that. I mean, it doesn't necessarily just have to be an affair. Maybe it's even losing a child. I mean, sometimes if you go through a miscarriage or a child dies or something like that, that bubbles everything up. But sometimes when you have these really big problematic things, these really big traumas that happen to you as a couple, it forces all of that to the surface and you either deal with it and move on, or it'll rip your entire relationship apart.
In which case, I will recommend the film The Rabbit Hole with Tom Cruise's former wife, the redhead.
Mimi?
No.
Nicole Kidman.
Yes, Nicole Kidman had won big time over at Cannes, I think, and I saw it after it was already on TV. Fantastic. You're going to need a huge box of tissues. Trust me on that one. I bawled like a baby through most of it. But it's about a couple who lose their child. It's the aftermath. It starts after they've already lost the child and they're trying to deal with that and dealing with it in separate ways. And just an amazing, amazing, amazing film. So going to recommend that. But I think we also have to start getting ready to go.
Yeah, we're going to have to get on out of here. So again, thank you guys so much for joining us every week. And if you have not done so, please go out to Mod Love Radio and join our listener club. And when you do, you'll get a couple of free gifts from us in your email. And you can also, if you're still doing some online dating and you're just not getting the results you want, you can get a set of free training videos that we've put up. It's right there on our homepage. If you put your name and your email address in the form box up at the right-hand side of the page, we will send you those emails that give you a really good idea of how to build a profile that's going to get you the people you want. We're going to talk about how what pictures work and what pictures don't, how to write your profile. I've got a formula that I use that works really, really, really well. I actually got a message from somebody that I helped with a profile not too long ago, and her exact words were, "It's going bananas." And then somebody else sent me an email the other day that said, "My inbox has been full." So I've been very excited that you know, people are getting some really good
fantastic,
really good results out of it. So yay! Thanks. And you know, if you guys have any listener questions or anything, make sure to email us. There's a contact form out there. You can email your questions too, as we love to answer your questions. And with that, we're gonna have to get on out of here. But thanks, guys. You've been listening to
Mod Love. Mod Love is produced by Straight Talk Entertainment. For information on producing your podcast, go to straighttalkwithsteve.net.